91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Last month marked the 7th anniversary of the catastrophic Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico. Who can forget the weeks that went by with oil actively gushing into the ocean and the environmental fears of the bordering states, including Florida? Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We'll visit with author and environmentalist Connie Mae Fowler, who lived close to the event and witnessed the devastation from the first days of the spill and the horrors which came after. Also documented is the obstruction of fact by BP, which desperately struggled to keep the spill minimized in the public's eye. Her book is called A Million Fragile Bones. First, NPR and regional news.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. I'm Bonnie Berman, and Joseph Cooper returns tomorrow. For some, it may seem like yesterday, for others, a lifetime ago. But April 20th marked the 7th anniversary of the catastrophic BP Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 men were killed, and it caused one of the worst environmental disasters in history, at least in the Gulf. It's rarely in the news anymore, but the tragedy continues to unfold to this day. We'll learn more in moments from award-winning novelist, memoirist, and environmentalist Connie Mae Fowler, who was on the ground from day one of the disaster. Her latest work is a memoir entitled A Million Fragile Bones. And she joins us from her home in Cozumel via Skype. Welcome to you, Connie Mae Fowler.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. I first have to say that this book is exquisitely written, and I want to thank you for that.
Oh, thank you so much.
Now, you were living in the Gulf region at the time of the disaster. You'd been there in Alligator Point, was it, for 20 years? Where is Alligator Point?
Alligator Point is south of Tallahassee in Franklin County. It's a little spit of a sandbar that sticks out into the northern Gulf of Mexico.
So it's pretty isolated. If you would tell us what brought you there and describe your physical and spiritual connection to the region.
Yes, Alligator Point, at least at that time, was quite isolated. And it was, you know, there were weekend homes, but mainly no one lived out there full time. And I had, as followers of my work know, I'd had a very, very violent childhood, and that, as those cycles sometimes do, goes on into adulthood, and I was searching for a way to heal from all of that. And I only discovered in the writing of the book that that healing was tied to coming to terms with my father, who died when I was six. Not so much coming to terms, but, you know, how much grief I had over his loss and my connection to him, because he loved to be out in the natural world. He was quite a fisherman. That connection to him, I felt, had been broken when he died. And so, unbeknownst to me, in the front of my brain, I was searching to reconnect. And I found Alligator Point, and I felt that it was a place he would love and would like to roam the way I started roaming it. And so I moved there. And sometimes I was the only human being out there. I spent my days immersed in nature. It was a really wonderful time of healing. I lived with, you know, bobcats and bear and whatever came ashore, and the amazing migrations. That's something that people don't necessarily realize about that Gulf Coast, but it is a place of migration, as is the northern Gulf of Mexico. So I went there and lived what I think was a really charmed life for 20 years, immersed in nature.
So take us back to April 20th, 2010. And tell us what happened, and perhaps there are some listeners who don't even know, because it was 7 years ago. I would think most people do, but what happened on that day, and when did the spill reach Alligator Point?
Well, we did not know anything about the explosion until April 21st. On April 20th, at about 10:45, The rig exploded in the northern Gulf of Mexico, about 50 miles south of the mouth of the Mississippi River. And the first word we got about it was the next evening in the evening news on April 21st. And that was the first news anyone got of it. And at that time, the Coast Guard and BP were saying that it was minor, this was no big deal, that 11 men were missing, but they were sure that they were alive. And as the news came across, I remember looking at my husband saying, how can that be? If that rig blew, this has to be serious. And you've got 11 men bobbing around in the northern Gulf of Mexico. How do they think that they're just missing? And indeed, within a week, we realized how very, very serious it was. The men were dead, and the Coast Guard was no longer saying it was all roses. They were saying this is a very, very serious spill.
Would you explain why spring, the time that it happened, was the worst time for a tragedy like this to occur?
Yes, there was no good time for an oil rig to explode, but this was absolutely the worst time because spring is a time of migration in the Northern Gulf. So everything, the Northern Gulf is a very shallow body of water. It's like this wonderful giant estuary, and it's where life begins. It's where the babies are able to be born and feel and are safe from a lot of predators and can grow into enough of an adult that they can then go into the open waters again. So everything's moving. Bluefin tuna is moving. Yellowfin tuna is moving. Dolphins are pregnant and are having babies. The sea turtles are moving through that northern Gulf of Mexico to those beaches in order to lay their eggs. So when that rig blew, all that new life was in peril.
Now, when did the spill reach Alligator Point? It took a while, correct?
It did take a while. Obviously, Louisiana was going to get the effects first, which they did, and they were severely, severely impacted. And then the spill and its effects kept moving eastward. So there was this gradual degradation of the environment at Alligator Point. And at first, you would see it affected shellfish a lot initially. That was the first kind of wave of dead animals we were seeing. And then it's as if it moved up the food chain into larger and larger and larger animals. And also the water started becoming heavier and heavier. It looked viscous. And indeed it was, because it was weighed down with oil. So we went from massive amounts of dead crabs to dolphin deaths on the beach.
And you had your own experience with a baby dolphin.
I did. This was, oh goodness, about a year after the spill. And of course, the effects were still in full bloom. And I was a mess. Because I really did consider this spit of land by the sea a sacred space for me. It had healed me. And I spent 2 years doing nothing but bearing witness to what was happening. And it's like all those bones that I had healed felt like they were cracking again. And so I was walking the beach, and I saw a baby dolphin. And we had had so many dolphins die. And it was this thing just snapped in me that, okay, I can save this dolphin. I can save one, and maybe things will begin to get better. Mm. So insanely, I ran through that filthy water and got to the dolphin and held it, and it died in my arms.
That must have been so difficult. So this uprooted, I mean, it just totally uprooted you emotionally, mentally, and psychologically. Not to mention your health, which we're going to get to, but tell us about, well, first, let's talk about what BP did at the time. You talk about the lies and obstruction on the part of BP and the government, and that the media wasn't even allowed to report the facts or take pictures or the consequences of the spill as they happened. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. I mean, BP's whole modus operandi was to obfuscate, to make the spill disappear and to appear in all their PR statements as if everything was fine. They had cleaned it all up, come down to the Gulf Coast. It's all great. That is one of the reasons why they used this dispersant called Corexit, which is incredibly lethal, and when mixed with the oil, becomes an even more lethal compound. But what it did was it breaks the oil down into these tiny, tiny particles that become membrane permeable. So anything exposed to it, that oil and Corexit mix can go through that membrane and poison whatever it is, whether it's crab to human being. So while we were living through this, we were being told that nothing's wrong. And it felt like we were being corporate gaslit, to be honest with you. And at one point, Senator Markey said before Congress that there is a live cam and that BP owned it but was not allowing us to see the live cam of the oil spewing. And I think a lot of listeners will remember that the CNN, for instance, kept it down in the lower corner and all the time, and you could just see all this oil roiling through the water. And so he pushed and made BP make that open to the public, but they had that from day one. So my question has always been, if they had that from day one, they knew how severe the oil spill was from day one, but they only revealed it when Senator Markey forced them to reveal it. The Coast Guard basically said whatever BP wanted them to say. So those of us who lived along the Gulf really felt like we were kind of had gone down the rabbit hole. We knew what we were seeing. We knew what we were living. But the government and BP were telling us that was nonsense.
And you actually joined with other community activists at the time, correct, in an attempt to seek the truth about what was happening or what you could do to help?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we would form coalitions in order to understand and learn what we could do to help the oiled animals and the animals coming ashore. We created triage stations. Actually, social media became an incredibly important part of this because we could easily be in touch and organize. But BP stymied our efforts continually, saying that they would bring their own people in. And that, so the local folks were completely blocked out. They did employ fishermen to go out into the oil and try to basically corral it. They, too, were very restricted in what they could do. So it was, you know, on all fronts, it was really an incredible nightmare, and we could never figure out exactly what it was BP wanted until we started to wake up and realize what they wanted was for us to go away and not say anything else about the spill. You know, as a result of this and the use of dispersant, there is a giant mat of oil on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico, of oil and dispersant, so it's doubly toxic and it's degrading, and degraded oil is even more toxic. So, but you can't see it. So again, see no evil, then everything's fine. You can't see it, you don't see the oil bird, then they're not going to have such bad PR.
We're going to talk more about the Corexit and the effects it had on humans as well, including you. We're speaking with Connie Mae Fowler. She's an award-winning novelist, memoirist, and screenwriter, an environmentalist. Her latest book is A Million Fragile Bones. It's a memoir. And we're going to take a short break on today's Topical Currents. We'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with Connie Mae Fowler. She's an award-winning novelist, memoirist, and screenwriter, also an environmentalist and a teacher. Her latest work is a memoir, A Million Fragile Bones. And we were talking about the Corexit, Connie, when we left off. That chemical, if I'm correct, is banned in many other countries. Is that correct?
It's banned in most all industrialized nations, including Great Britain, which is where, of course, BP is from.
So do we know for certain if they were aware, if BP was aware of the potential devastating consequences of the Corexit and used it anyway, or were they just not aware? But you're saying it's banned in Great Britain.
Right. They're very aware. The EPA was very aware. The EPA asked them not to use it and to come up with a list of other dispersants that were less toxic. And they didn't do that. They used Corexit to the bitter end.
Do we know now how the spill should have been treated? Were there other methods that were ignored or that were not known at the time?
Well, this is a very, very complex question. And part of it goes back to an essential question, which is, should we be drilling at those depths?
Well,
you know,
right.
I mean, there was, they don't know. They, and clearly by everything they tried to do to try to cap the well, they clearly had no idea what they were doing. So my position is how can we allow drilling and that at those depths, and we don't know what to do when there's a catastrophic accident. There was a problem with the blowout preventers. It turns out that's not just BP's problem. The blowout preventer was made with an engineering issue, and they are now trying to, 7 years out, continue to address that. But this will take years and years to refit all those oil wells with blowout preventers that don't have this issue.
So they still don't have an answer to something like this. In other words, were something like this to happen again, we'd be in the same situation.
We'd be in the same situation, yes.
Now, BP paid a huge amount of money for the disaster. Do you feel it was adequate? The damage to the marine and wildlife can't benefit from the money that was paid. Do you feel like the region got the compensation that it needed or that would make it whole again?
Well, you know, this disaster is ongoing, as you said at the beginning of the show, and no one knows if the Gulf will ever return to its pre-spill state or how long it will take. So for me, I don't know how you put a dollar amount on that, but I do know that BP was fined $18 billion. That sounds like a lot of money, but it's $18 billion to be paid out over 18 years, and the majority of that money they can take as a tax deduction. So no, for me, it's not enough.
Let's talk about the current state of the Gulf and the fish and wildlife and marine life in the region right now. What you say, and I did say it's an ongoing, because when I read in your book, it's incredible the effects that are still happening that we don't know about. And as I said, it's not in the news. But let's look at some of the individual species, such as the dolphins and the sea turtles, and how they're faring today.
Yes, there have been different organizations and also research organizations from universities that are now beginning to see the results of their research. And the National Wildlife Fund did a comprehensive 5- and 6-year study. And in terms of dolphins, they say in the first 5 years after the disaster, more than 3/4 of pregnant bottlenose dolphins failed to give birth to a live calf. And that has not statistically changed 2 years later. So the dolphin numbers have plummeted because of what the Corexit and oil do together. It is affecting the dolphins' ability to bring their births to term. It's giving them cancers and different and affecting the reproductive systems. In terms of turtles, it's estimated that 65,000 of the already embattled Kemp's Ridley turtles die. Now, these estimates are probably quite low because all we could count were the animals that died on shore. So we don't have numbers for all the animals that died at sea. The sea turtles, for instance, as they were, because they're not deep divers, they're on the surface. And so as they were swimming north to those northern Gulf of Mexico beaches, BP was burning the oil off the surface of the Gulf. So they were burning these animals alive. So we don't have real numbers, but in terms of the Kemp's Ridley, we know that at least 65,000 died, but they only reproduce every 10 to 12 years. So we're at least 3 years out before we'll know the true extent of whether they're going to be able to recover or not.
And then there's the tuna. You talk about the tuna.
Yeah, you know, and tuna was already embattled also. And so what's happening with the tuna is that they are being born with both jaw defects, which is very odd, but jaw defects and heart problems. with malformed hearts, so they have heart attacks very shortly after birth, or they have heart arrhythmias, which lead to the same things, or it also means that they can't swim as fast, so they can't get away from prey. So, you know, it's a mushroom effect. You know, they're born embattled, and then all these other things happen to them so that their numbers are also decreasing.
Now, the car exit also affected the people in the Gulf region, and there's a reason that you're speaking to us today from Cozumel and not Alligator Point. What happened to you?
Well, again, that mixture of Corexit and oil is even more deadlier than either substance alone. But the Corexit, they sprayed, and every day they were spraying immense amounts of this on the surface of the Gulf. I lived right on the coast, and I didn't leave the coast to go to work. I worked at home because I'm a writer, so I was exposed 24/7. And just like, you know, if you're crop dusting, if that wind blows, that poison is going to blow back over you. You know, BP said that couldn't happen. Well, of course it happens. The sea breeze is blowing that chemical back across the coastal area. And so my first indication was that I started developing, I mean, it's really gross, these thick mucousy masses in my mouth. I mean, so thick that I would have to literally reach in and clear out my mouth because I would not be able to speak, would almost glue my mouth shut. And so what I was having, I realize now, my doctors tell me, is a very, very bad reaction to that chemical. As a result, I've had several bouts of pneumonia. I have become very, very sensitive to chemical poisons in the environment, anything from tobacco to mold to and just anything. My lungs are now not what they used to be, and my doctors say it is as a result of the exposure to the Corexit. So, so I left the region for my health.
Do you miss it?
Oh, I miss it terribly. Yes.
We're speaking with Connie Mae Fowler. She's an award-winning novelist, and perhaps you know some of her other works, Before Women Had Wings, Remembering Blue, When Katie Wakes. If you'd like to speak with her about her work now or anything, A Million Fragile Bones, our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Our email is radio@wlrn.org. Roseanne wants to know if there was any effort from BP to try and stop the publication of your book, Connie.
Not that I know of. There are some things that I really don't feel comfortable talking about that are because it's supposition, but so far, so good.
Okay. What do you think should happen now in terms of additional damages from BP or other measures you think should be taken? Is there anything that you think could be done or anything you'd like to see on the part of our government do other than not, of course, going so deep with an oil rig?
Yeah, well, one thing, I think that right now we are seeing more and more effects on the human population, and there are starting to be more studies, but the people who are deeply affected, their health has been affected, they need relief. So that's one thing that needs to happen. I think that we have a new administration that is, their position is that, you know, it's drill, baby, drill. And they have proposed to open up 73 million acres to drilling in the Gulf of Mexico off of Florida, Alabama, Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi over the next 5 years. I would prefer that our emphasis be on sustainable energy, green energies, and research and development of those energies rather than putting us whole hog into fossil fuels, but that doesn't seem to be the case. And if we are insistent on doing that, we have to have better safety measures in place.
Like blowout preventers that can be adapted to the rigs that are there.
You know, 5 years out, they figured out that there was this issue with the blowout preventer. But these are ginormous pieces of equipment. They figured out a new design. but it will take years and years to manufacture all the ones that they need. And then how do they replace the old ones with the new ones? I mean, it's a mess. I don't really see it ever happening, probably not in my lifetime. But when you've got, you know, a major oil company saying, let's try something called a junk shot, where they basically just propel a bunch of junk at the gaping hole, hoping that will stop the oil spew, we have a problem.
We're speaking with Connie Mae Fowler about her latest memoir, A Million Fragile Bones, about the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. If you'd like to call, our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Our email is radio@WLRN.org. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. We're visiting with Connie Mae Fowler. She's an award-winning novelist, memoirist, and screenwriter, and environmentalist. And her latest memoir is A Million Fragile Bones. Other works, Before Women Had Wings, Remembering Blue, When Katie Wakes. If you want to speak to Connie Mae Fowler, you're welcome to call us, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Our email is radio@WLRN.org. Connie, you've written about so many of your past traumas. I was just wondering how this environmental trauma, what it was like writing about this compared to perhaps more personal losses, although this sounds like it was also a very personal loss, but how it compared?
Yeah, I think that because that place that I, that sense of place that I developed there, and how I really did feel like it was a sacred space for me, and that I brought with me all those family bones and family stories and started to come into my own. I think that it was probably the most difficult, emotionally most difficult story for me to write. Also, there's the aspect that in memoir, it kind of, it suggests that you have some time, it's memory, but I was writing it as this was happening. So I had to impose some sort of distance on myself that time didn't provide, and because there wasn't a natural buffer of time, I think that the writing of it became pretty difficult at times.
I would say that it was very difficult to read. I don't want to discourage people from reading it, because I think it's an important book, but it was so painful. And now, as you just mentioned, it looks as though environmental issues are only getting a little bit more difficult, and it sometimes feels overwhelming. Do you feel a responsibility as an artist to bring attention to issues like this?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that one of the things that all artists do is bear witness. And I don't know why I was there when that happened, but if I really felt an incredible duty to write the story, to write it down, because I don't want us to forget, and I want us to know what truly happened. It's, you know, and that's important at any stage of development and civilization, but I think it's incredibly important now because so many environmental protections are being rolled back. You know, BP, it wasn't just their blowout preventer. There was a series of decisions they made based on money that caused this catastrophe to happen. And they seem to think that that's the cost of doing business. They get a fine, they pay the fine, a lot of it's a tax write-off, and they keep going. But who is going to say you have to play by the rules? There were safety regulations in place that they willfully ignored, and that contributed directly to the disaster.
Let's talk to Brian from Fort Lauderdale. If I understand, you work for BP. Brian, welcome.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, that's correct. I was actually a Transocean employee and worked on a sister rig to the Horizon. And then after the Horizon sank, I worked to clean a lot of the vessels that were covered by oil. My question is, as a former Transocean employee, I've worked on many rigs, and you know, everybody's pointing the finger at BP, BP this. There's only like three or four BP employees on any given rig contracted by BP. the company in charge of drilling, the expert who was hired by BP to drill these holes, is Transocean. Transocean maintained the blowout preventer and all the equipment on board the rig. Why has there been no assigned blame to Transocean? You know, I equate it to, you know, if you have a clogged drain at your house, you call a plumber. But if the plumber makes a mistake and floods your neighborhood with sewage, everybody sues the house owner? Being BP?
Connie?
Yeah, you know, there was, I don't know if you've read it, but it is worth the read, and it sounds like it's dry, but it's not. It's the report the Presidential Commission report on the disaster, and they clearly do hold Transocean responsible also. But as I understand it, and the way I read that report, and evidently the way the courts also approached it, is that, you know, where does the buck stop? And they all decided that the buck stopped with BP.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, Brian. Thank you for calling. Again, our number is 1-800-743-9576. You can speak to Connie Mae Fowler about this, A Million Fragile Bones, or any of her other works. 1-800-743-9576. Our email is radio@wlrn.org. Just to change to something a little more upbeat, you got an interesting call about your Before Women Had Wings. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. It was about maybe a week or two before the book was actually out. And I was in my backyard hoeing the garden, and the phone rang. And I go up on the back porch with a hoe, and I pick up the phone, drop the hoe. There's all this clatter, and I finally get the phone to my ear. And the person says that she was a friend of Bird's. And Bird was the protagonist in the book, but that didn't click right then. And I thought it was a crank call. So I'm like, excuse me? And she repeated it. And I finally say, with no small measure of irritation in my voice, I am sorry, but I have no idea who this is. And she said, it's Oprah. And my brilliant response was, Oprah? And she said, yes, Oprah Winfrey. So, yeah, that was quite the phone call. And so she said that if she could figure out how to make that book into a movie, she would. And she did. Yes, it was great. It was a wonderful experience.
And so you wrote the screenplay for that?
I did.
Okay. And is that the only screenplay you've written?
It is, yes. Wow. And I did not want to write that one. They pulled me screaming and crying, but they eventually convinced me. They felt like they needed someone who intimately knew and understood the material. And in the course of our conversations, it became kind of clear to me that was true. So I reluctantly signed on, but I'm glad I did.
We want to, okay, Robert in Jupiter. Let's talk to Robert. Robert, welcome. You're on Topical Currents.
Thank you very much. Has there been any documentary filmmakers approach you to do some work on this? I know there's been other documentaries made, but yours is a little more personal, and you're a well-known author. And especially with the political environment right now, I think that there'd be a few of them that would just absolutely love to take this on.
Well, not yet, but I am all ears.
Still waiting. Another Oprah might call.
That's right.
Not Oprah, but somebody else.
Well,
yes,
hopefully,
we'll
hopefully after this, it'll happen. Thanks, guys.
Okay, thank you for calling, Robert. Again, our number is 1-800-743-9576. Do you know the extent of the economic impact on the region today?
I do not have those figures, but I do know that the states have recently, like, for instance, the state of Florida has just passed a resolution that the monies from BP would only go to those counties that were directly affected by the oil spill. When BP was first, the money was adjudicated, the entire state was trying to get hold of the money. And, you know, there was some reason for it. I mean, Orlando was saying, look, you know, we lost tourism because of it. But nevertheless, they weren't as severely as impacted as those northern coastal counties. So that has just been decided. I mean, it's kind of fascinating to watch. 7 years out, and we are just now figuring out who gets the money.
Yeah, that is. What about the fishermen you were saying who were actually out there cleaning up the spill and their contact with the car exit?
Yeah, they are starting to have very, very severe health repercussions, and it goes from everything from skin lesions that will not heal to very serious, as if there's non-serious, but some, you know, to cancer. So there are now health organizations that are starting to look at this far more seriously. There are law firms involved, including one from Miami. But, you know, it's not as if the government was proactive in saying, let's help these people. And the courts haven't yet been proactive in saying, let's help these people.
Hmm. We're speaking with Connie Mae Fowler. She's an award-winning novelist, memoirist, and screenwriter of Before Women Had Wings, an environmentalist. Do you still teach the Creative Writing MFA program at the Vermont College of Fine Arts?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And we're going to take our last break. Her latest book is a memoir, A Million Fragile Bones. We're going to take our last break, and we'll be right back. Again, our number, 1-800-743-9576. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. Joseph Cooper returns tomorrow. We're speaking with Connie Mae Fowler about her latest memoir, A Million Fragile Bones, about the deep water horizon oil spill. And we have callers and emails. I want to read you this email, Connie, from Courtney. I spent 2 years living in Tallahassee and regularly visited Alligator Point from 2011 to 2013. Having grown up in rural Wisconsin, it was the only place that could console me as I learned to adapt to life in the South and living so far from everything I'd ever known. I keep a photo I took of a little crab making his way around the beach there, hanging in our home as a reminder to spend time watching the world around me and to enjoy even the smallest gifts in life. It's wonderful to know those waters had healing powers for others. For me, it was in the midst of the horror that was Deepwater Horizon. Maybe a glimmer of hope that all was not lost. Thank you for your work now and then and for taking me back to those gorgeous shores as I toil away at my desk today in Delray Beach.
That's very, very nice. You know, one thing that I'd like to say is that, you know, before the rig exploded, we were working very hard in the Northern Gulf, and we had organized to try to stop the legislature from approving offshore drilling off of Florida. And then in the midst of this, the oil rig blew, and it did not blow off of Florida. It blew off of Louisiana, but we were affected. We were impacted severely, and we tend to think of these, you know, we compartmentalize. It's like, oh, well, we won't allow it in Florida. They can do what they want in Louisiana. But the fact of the matter is, you know, it affected the entire Gulf. It affected the Gulf area that abuts Mexico. It affected the Gulf area that abuts Cuba. That loop current, that is the Gulf of Mexico, goes out into the Atlantic. There are no real boundaries. Those boundaries are man-made. So, you know, we can say, oh, it was the Northern Gulf Coast, but it was our planet. And we all need to get involved because it affects all of us. It affected the Northern Gulf Coast most obviously, but that water doesn't stay there. It goes all across the globe.
Nor do the fish.
Exactly.
Let's talk to John in Coral Gables. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Yes, I've been on the Sea Level Rise Task Force for the Four County Climate Compact. And what I would like to say is that we need to leave at least 80, probably 90% of the oil in the ground, or it isn't going to harm anything. And the method to make that happen is to put a price on carbon so that it becomes less advantageous to use polluting forms of energy rather than renewable energy, and refund the money that's collected to the people so that it doesn't burden the economy. That would move this whole process rather than dealing with one spill here, one spill there, you know, the usual litany. We need to get the overarching problem under control by putting a price on it that's high enough to roll back production and ramp up the renewable energy future, which is already unfolding on a massive scale out west and in California, pretty much everywhere except Florida.
Right. Connie?
Yeah, oh, I absolutely agree. I mean, we have to have things in place that promote these new sources of energy. You know, the fact of the matter is renewable energy is creating jobs 12 times faster than the rest of the economy. This is good for the economy. It is not bad for the economy, but it's also good for the earth. And because of the way we're set up, the way, you know, we work with our economics, yes, you have to have economic incentives. I absolutely agree with the caller.
Thank you very much, John, for calling.
You're welcome.
And let's go to Steve in Miami. Welcome, Steve.
Yes, good afternoon. Actually, you know, there is an elephant in the room that hasn't been discussed. That is the dreaded regulations. In other countries, Canada, Britain included, to do deep-sea well drilling, it is absolutely necessary that you have a redundant parallel pipe going down to where you are drilling. That backflow preventer that we're discussing that doesn't work, that was invented to eliminate the regulation for America. So, in other words, they didn't have to have a redundant pipe because they eliminated the regulation for it by a backflow preventer that doesn't work.
Are you aware of...
That's what the story should be about.
Okay. Connie, are you aware of this?
I do know that while it was happening, there was a lot of questions about why wasn't there the second pipe. And I never heard anyone answer that in any way that was satisfactory. And you know, the caller might be absolutely right. Maybe they changed out one for the other, and the result was devastating.
Well, the truth is that just by eliminating regulation doesn't make you smart in how to make something work.
Right.
The fact is that that doesn't happen in other countries because there's a redundant pipe. And we don't do it, and it's going to happen again.
I suspect you're right. We don't have any redundancies built in. And even though this was one of the worst disasters we have ever seen, nothing has happened to make sure that any further redundancies are created. And I don't see it happening because of how we are now viewing regulations in this country. It's the dirtiest word that you can say just about anymore.
Right now.
You are right, but you ask the average American what regulation hurts them, and you won't get an answer because they don't know. The only people regulations hurt are companies like this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Steve.
And it's just a fact. We need to understand that.
Right. Well, thank you very much for your views.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jose from West Palm Beach, welcome.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking a call. I find the topic kind of interesting. I had an opportunity to work several months there at the cleanup, specifically in Pensacola, different marinas there, and then working my way over to Apalachicola. As they expected, they actually expected the spill to go around, down through Tampa, around, over to Miami, and on up following the current. So we were prepared to move around, and I was part of the group that started moving on, trying to stay on up ahead of the incoming, what they call the weathered oil. That's what they called it, which was almost seemed like a peanut butter paste. By the time it got to us, we were from the shore out 20 miles doing cleanup and responding to sightings of oil. And it was like a peanut butter type consistency and also the sight of it, the color of it looked like peanut butter. We had an opportunity to share some experiences with people that were going a lot further out, and they were coming back on their leaves. When they were coming back on leave, they would bring not only their experiences, but also somehow some of them had gotten a hold of a film or videos from underwater apparatuses that showed very weird behavior by marine life. Mm. Some of them, I remember very clearly one of them, it was a very large type of marine life, that was spinning around, swimming, without any kind of, usually a odd behavior. And also, very large fishes that were actually biting onto underwater hoses and piping, which was, we found it very, it's just very spooky.
Connie, do you... Were you affected health-wise, Jose?
No, I was not.
Okay. Connie, any comment?
Yeah, you know, something that kind of miraculous happened in all of this, and that is that the loop current created a giant eddy, and it started because he's right. The projections were for that oil to go right along the tip of Florida and up the East Coast. That eddy that formed helped prevent that. But they are finding oil in the sands all the way down the Florida coast. And if you go online and look up some, if you can still find them, EPA and NOAA maps, they show the extent of where that oil actually traveled. And we didn't think that it was there, but it was. But I'm very glad that his health is good, and I hope it stays good. It's heartbreaking to hear about the animals, but you cannot do that. You cannot put those poisons into the environment and think that it's not going to create a toxic situation for life.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things that it doesn't get discussed much is that BP originally applied for drilling that well in 500 feet of water, which all of the equipment would have been sufficient and perhaps would have worked perfectly. But the EPA, the federal government, got involved and it says, no, you're not going to drill at 500. You're going to drill out there at the Texas Canyon, the canyon that is actually formed by the force of the Mississippi River underwater. It had carved this canyon, and that's where they were assigned to drill. So they were assigned to drill in an area where the equipment was destined to fail. Because of the depth.
Oh. Jose, we're out of time. I'm very sorry to interrupt you, but we're at the end of the show, so I have to thank you for your call, though.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you very much. Do you have any comment on that, about what he just said about the 400 or the 500 feet?
No, clearly it would have been a completely different situation in 500 feet. One of the things, we don't understand 5,000 feet. We didn't even understand the temperatures. The cement that they were using, which would work in 500 feet, wouldn't work at 5,000 because of the temperature difference. So it's like you're going to drill, in your backyard versus you're going to try to go to the moon and think it's going to work.
Connie, we are out of time, but I want to read something you wrote in your preface. My life has been marked by moments of profound loss, but in the midst of pain and bewilderment, eventually I insist on hope. So I'd like to leave with that from Connie Mae Fowler. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. It's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. Connie Mae Fowler is an award-winning novelist, memoirist, and screenwriter, environmentalist, and her latest book is A Million Fragile Bones. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us for today's Topical Currents. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from operations manager and online producer Jason Zapka. Polly Landis is associate producer. As always, it's easy to download each program at our website, WLRN.org. There's also the Topical Currents Facebook page and the iTunes podcast. Tomorrow's program is with a Miami-Dade municipality mayor who's served multiple terms, but he's also a scientist at FIU professor. We'll visit with South Miami Mayor Dr. Philip Stoddard tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Bonnie Berman for Joseph Cooper. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.